From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we present a 1991 concert of Cole Porter songs performed by Barbara Lee. Jazz critic Leonard Feather has died at the age of 80. We'll feature an interview from 1987 in which he looked back on his life in jazz. And film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of The New Age, starring Judy Davis and Peter Weller. It's written and directed by Michael Tolkin, who wrote the novel and the screenplay The Player. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Anne Bozell. Exiled Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide met with members of Congress today, urging the U.S. to keep its forces in Haiti until stability is restored. He also told key senators he is grateful for the presence of U.S. troops. Meanwhile, President Clinton says the situation in Haiti is quieter and calmer today, and the president said conditions will continue to improve as Haitians surrender their weapons and as international police monitors arrive. Speaking at a bill signing ceremony, the president said some of the Haitian refugees now being detained at the American military base at Guantanamo Bay will begin going home beginning on Monday. High-level talks between the United States and North Korea aimed at eliminating the North's suspected nuclear weapons program have resumed in Geneva. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
The main goal of U.S. negotiators is to wrest a pledge from North Korea to open two suspected nuclear waste sites to international inspection. North Korea says these aren't nuclear facilities, they're sensitive military ones, and inspections would compromise their security. But Tokyo, Seoul, and Washington insist it's Pyongyang that's subverting the regional peace by refusing to make its nuclear program transparent. And while the U.S. appears to be more flexible on when inspections could occur, South Korea and Japan made plain, without them, North Korea will get no diplomatic recognition or money. But the North is hanging tough. Pyongyang officials were quoted in published reports in Tokyo today, saying if calls to open persist, the North may halt plans the U.S. is pushing to convert its nuclear reactors to ones that produce less plutonium. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
Slow going on Capitol Hill this week as congressional Republicans use the last days of the 103rd session to put the brakes on any new legislation. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Republicans are making no secret of being obstructionists. They're blatantly blocking legislation, launching filibusters against campaign finance reform, a desert protection bill, and even an international trade accord, which they strongly support. Texas Republican Phil Graham, who heads the Senate Campaign Committee, said weeks ago Congress should simply go home. He hopes the election will upset the balance of power in the Senate. Graham and other Republicans say the American people want gridlock if it means stopping bad legislation. But they're blocking the desert bill because it could help California Democrat Dianne Feinstein, who's up for re-election. And they're holding the trade accord hostage to stop Democrats from introducing a scaled-back version of health reform in the final legislative days. Minority Leader Bob Dole says bluntly he wants health reform at the top of the agenda after the election when he may be majority leader. I'm Elizabeth Arnold. At the Capitol.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down about 7.5 points at 3829.73. This is NPR News in Washington. A Superior Court judge has ruled that most of the evidence gathered in a June 28 search of O.J. Simpson's home will be admissible in Simpson's double murder trial. And Judge Lance Ito also says he will consider limiting news coverage of the trial, which begins on Monday. Ito expressed anger at media coverage, singling out a Los Angeles television station, which he says broadcast an erroneous story about DNA evidence, despite being told the information was incorrect. Ito says he will consider early next week whether to take action against the station. In Germany, it is now a criminal offense to deny the Holocaust took place. NPR's Deirdre Berger reports.
Germany's upper house of parliament has given final approval to the new law. Anyone who publicly contests the existence of the Holocaust can get up to a 5-year prison sentence. Bonn government officials drafted the law earlier this year after public outrage at a high court ruling that seemed to protect certain forms of Holocaust denial as freedom of expression. The case caused renewed uproar this summer when a local judge praised the character of the man charged with falsifying the Holocaust. Justice authorities in Berlin recently brought charges against a German neo-Nazi leader who questioned the existence of gas chambers in Auschwitz in a recent documentary film. The upper house of parliament also passed a controversial crime law today that gives law enforcement authorities limited access to evidence collected by intelligence agencies. I'm Dietrich Berg in Frankfurt.
The U.S. Coast Guard has officially ended patrols for Cuban refugees. A spokesman says the full-scale operation ended yesterday, 2 weeks after the U.S. and Cuba agreed to stem the flow of boat people. However, he says the Coast Guard will maintain routine patrols. Secretary of State Christopher says he's optimistic that Syria and Israel are serious about a peace accord. He says he'll make at least one trip to the Middle East to try and help iron out remaining differences. I'm Ann Bozell in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition of our show, we have a concert of Cole Porter songs performed by Barbara Lee. I enjoyed her version of Begin the Begin so much, I kept a tape of it in my car for months. New York Times music critic John S. Wilson described Lee as one of the most knowledgeable interpreters and collectors of popular songs. She made her first record in the mid-50s. Our concert was recorded in 1991 to commemorate the 100th anniversary of Cole Porter's birth. Accompanying Barbara Lee was Tony Tamburello, who often accompanied Tony Bennett in performance and had worked as Sinatra's rehearsal pianist. Tamburello has since passed away. Here's Barbara Lee.
This song is from Jubilee, the show which gave us Begin the Begin and Just One of Those Things. And it concerned, I think, a native princess on a South Sea island dreaming of Hollywood and the States and romance and so on. Very lovely ballad. All my life I've been so secluded, love has eluded me. But from knowing secondhand what I'd do of it, I feel certain I could stand a closer view of it. Till today I've studied love discreetly, but now that I'm completely free, I must find some kind persona grata to give me data personally. When romance passes by, why shouldn't I know of love? Why wait around when each age has a sage who has earth, love is all that is really worth thinking of. It must be fun, lots of fun, to be sure when day is done that the hour is coming. Be kissed again. All debutantes say it's good, and every star out in far Hollywood seems to give it a try. So why shouldn't
I. That's beautiful. Tell me, if you could, what makes Cole Porter singular to you? Why you love his songs? What makes him different from other composers?
Gosh, you know, each great composer has his own particular way of writing. Cole Porter had a wonderful musical ear as well as wonderful musical training. And one thing that he did was vary the melody slightly in each eight bars. He'd go da-da in one and then da-da and then da-da, and he would do little variations, so it wasn't just the straight repetition. And they were very rich musically. The lyrics, of course, he was incomparably romantic. I really don't think any other lyric writer was as unabashedly passionate as Cole Porter. And at the same time, he had, of course, the marvelous cleverness, the great knowledge to write those laundry list songs of his and so on. And yet they weren't simply laundry lists. The way he shifted the interior rhymes around. People think rhymes are just rhymes. Not at all. Rhymes have everything to do with the rhythm of a song, the line length and so on. They just have everything to do with the variety of a song. It almost doesn't matter what the rhyme is so much as where it's placed. And of course, if he sets something up, which he often does, he'll set it up so that you're expecting a certain rhyme, and he'll give you something else. He just had everything going for him.
Tony, do you want to add something from your perspective as a musician about Cole Porter?
Well, his harmonies are so sophisticated, they're a joy to play. It's always something fresh coming up in a chord. I must tell you, Jerry, you know, this celebration with the anniversary, I'm working in town in a restaurant, and the Italian waiter comes up to me and says, Tony, would you mind playing some Cold Water? It took me a minute to figure it out.
Is that how well he knew Cole Porter stuff?
No, but it was a request from some of the customers. They wanted to hear some Cole Porter, and he thought it was Cold Water.
Well, not everybody knows Cole Porter.
How about another song?
Oh, all right. This song is from a rather early Cole Porter show. I'm ashamed to say I can't remember the name of the show, but he wrote it, I believe, in the 20s while he was living in Paris and studying composition with Nadia Boulanger. And the verse particularly just shows the astonishing things that he was able to do, whether because of the influence of this legendary composer trainer or not, I don't know. But of course, it has that wonderful Cole Porter naughtiness. Since first you crossed my horizon with your load of love charms, I spend my whole time devising means to stay in your arms. There must be some tricky treatment that would cool my brain, for to me it's so plain, and you'll admit the fact that I'm practically sane. You're a bad influence on me. Sorry, but you're a bad influence, I must say. For I get in such a dither when you use your famous come hither, that all thought of hame and mither seems to wither away. The thing your eyes do to me is such folly that I feel sure your middle name must be Svengali. You throw me right off of my stride. Still, I beg of you, stay by my side and be a bad influence on me. Start shooting, 'cause I'm sure you used to say black mass with Rasputin. I wish you'd cease singeing my wings, but before you do, take off your things and be a bad influence on me.
That was great. It's a wonderful lyric. It must be really nice to sing songs that you can sing with conviction because the lyric's so well written. You don't have to be embarrassed by any lines.
Yes. Sometimes you get a request for a song that isn't well written, and then it's really a test. It's really a challenge to think, what am I going to do? This is such a nice person. I want to do this song for this person. What can I do to it to make this lyric come alive? And what can I do to get over these embarrassing places? Often you find you just have to go counter to the intent of a song. Sometimes it'll be so ridiculously romantic that you have to take it very casually, or sometimes it's a kind of casual, hard-boiled song that you have to bring romance to. It's just...
Can you think of an example?
No. at this moment.
Okay.
No.
Barbara Lee, I want to find out a little bit about you.
Oh, all right.
Now, you started recording back in 1955.
Yes.
What were you like then? How was your voice different? What were you singing?
My voice was very much the same, except that for the last 5 years or so, I've been solvent, so I've been able to take voice lessons.
You're taking voice lessons now?
Now. I've just started, and it's wonderful, and it hasn't changed my voice at all, except it's easier. Everything flows more easily now. It's opened up the range. I've got a little more range on top and a little more on the bottom. Basically, I've had the same range since I was a tiny child. You know, people would say, you're Barbara Leacock. I haven't seen you since you were 4 years old. I'd know you anywhere by your voice.
Barbara Leacock, huh?
That was me.
That was your real name?
Yes, from Detroit.
And you changed it to Barbara Lee to perform?
Yes.
We're featuring a 1991 concert of Cole Porter songs with Barbara Lee. The late Tony Tamborello accompanied her. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with a 1991 concert of Cole Porter songs with Barbara Lee.
When we asked you to do the concert, we asked you to do some songs that we'd all know and a couple of songs that would be discoveries for us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the song you're about to do is something that's going to be a discovery for us.
Yes, I hope so. I've never heard anyone else do it. I just found a piece of sheet music in Lincoln Center Library. It was sung by the mother of the debutante in, I think, the New Yorkers. Not the New Yorkers. Oh, goodness, I'm going to goof everything. Paris? 50 Million Frenchmen. That's it. He wrote so many Paris shows and so many New York shows, I get them mixed up. 50 Million Frenchmen. What is that, my note?
You like that one?
Give me a card. Don't give me a note. My mother and father once went to a lot of bother to make me the happiest of girls. To further my station, they gave me an education, not to mention a string of pearls. But in spite of my backing, I still feel there's something lacking, and that fate has rather let me down. For instead of being famous, I'm an unknown ignoramus from a small Middle Western town. Why couldn't I have been Salome or Mary Pickford or Joan of Arc? If I were Eleanor Glynn or even Anne Boleyn, the future wouldn't look half so dark. Why couldn't I be Whistler's mother or any other woman of note? Why did the gods decree that I should only be the Queen of Terra Haute?
That's great. So you found that on sheet music.
Yes.
And you've never heard it performed?
No.
Mm-mm. You think it's recorded anywhere?
I don't know. Huh. I don't know. I know it's from the 20s. I can just see Mary Boland or somebody kind of wandering out onto a stage disconsolately. For some reason, I see her with a suitcase in her hand.
So this is the kind of thing you do a lot, just go searching for sheet music of obscure songs.
Oh, yes. Yes, it's my favorite pastime.
And we'll contrast that with a very well-known song that you're about to sing for us.
When they begin the begin, it brings back the sound of music so tender. It brings back a night of tropical splendor. It brings back a memory evergreen. I'm with you once more under the stars, and down by the shore an orchestra's playing, and even the palms seem to be swaying. When they begin the begin, to live it again is past all endeavor, except when that tune clutches my heart, and there we are swearing to love forever, promising never, never to part. What moments divine, what rapture serene, till clouds came along to disperse the joys we had tasted. And now when I hear people curse the chance that was wasted, I know but too well what they mean. So don't let them begin the begin. Let the love that was once a fire remain an ember. Let it sleep like the dead desire I only remember. When they begin the begin. Let them begin the begin, make them play, till the stars that were there before return above you, till you whisper to me once more, darling,
I love you. And we suddenly know what heaven we're in when they begin the beginning.
That's beautiful. I think that's the saddest and most felt version of that I've ever heard. It's usually much more kind of up-tempo and
yes.
danceable. And
yeah.
Tell me about thinking through the song and deciding it to do it that way.
Well, all I can tell you is that you have to know the story before you can tell the story. People are so interested in selling their sadness or selling their joy or whatever it is, but they don't ever bother to feel that. And I just, you know, I was an actress for many years, and I know what that song's about from my life. If I didn't know what it was about from my life, I'd know what it was about from my imagination. And I tell the story. That's all. And I love it. I love that. I think it's possibly the greatest song ever written. I know it's never been done this way. And I know if they try, they won't be able. So this song is mine. New York, New York is Liza Minnelli's. This one is mine.
Barbara Lee and pianist Tony Tamburello, recorded in 1991. Barbara Lee is featured on a recent recording by Lauren Schoenberg and his jazz orchestra called Manhattan Work Song. This is their version of Stardust. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
You wandered down the lane and far away, leaving me a song that will not die. Love is now the stardust of yesterday. The music of the years gone by. Sometimes I wonder why I spend the lonely nights dreaming of a song, the melody. And I am once again with you. When our love was new and each kiss an inspiration, but that was long ago, and now my consolation is in the stardust of a song. Beside the garden wall, when stars are bright, you are in my arms. The nightingale tells his fairy tale of paradise where roses grew. Though I dream in vain, in my heart it will remain that stardust.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Record producer and jazz critic Leonard Feather has died at the age of 80. Feather was also the author of the Encyclopedia of Jazz, which is one of the standard jazz reference works. We'll feature an interview from 1987, in which Feather talked about his life in jazz and many of the great musicians he'd worked with. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The New Age, starring Judy Davis and Peter Weller. It's directed by Michael Tolkin, who also wrote The Player. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. The judge in the O.J. Simpson case is threatening to restrict media coverage of the trial, which begins on Monday. Judge Lance Ito is angry about one L.A. television station's incorrect report about DNA evidence. In a pretrial hearing today, the judge ruled on a defense motion to suppress some evidence seized by police in a raid on Simpson's home on June 28th. The judge ruled most of the evidence may be used in Simpson's trial. The U.S. mission in Haiti is taking on a routine of its own. U.S. military personnel will be moving out into the rural areas of the country in the coming days to keep an eye on the Haitian police and military. The BBC's Hugh Schofield reports from Port-au-Prince.
On the fifth day of their occupation of Haiti, American forces are breaking into a kind of rhythm. Regular meetings are taking place between General Shelton and Raoul Cedras, the latest this morning. As significant, the commander of the Port-au-Prince police force, the notorious Colonel Michel François, has re-emerged to start coordinating with his counterpart in charge of the military police. Today, the first motorized patrols are starting, and three special forces detachments are heading out from the capital, their task to meet civil and military leaders around the country and assess how to move forward to the next phase of the mission. The initial confusion over rules of engagement has been cleared up. They can step in to protect Haitians. Even the leader of the infamous FRAP, responsible for much of the terror of the past years, says he's told his men to put away their guns.
Hugh Schofield reporting from Port-au-Prince. On Capitol Hill, Senate Republicans are continuing a filibuster aimed at blocking action on a campaign finance reform measure. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
One after another, Republican senators stood up last night to blast the campaign reform bill, which limits how much congressional candidates can spend on their campaigns and where they get their money from. Democrats are still trying to come up with a compromise that will satisfy House incumbents and senators. They're divided over the issue of contributions from political action committees. The Senate wants to ban all PAC contributions. The House wants to keep current limits. But Republicans say any campaign finance reform that includes public funding amounts to welfare for politicians. Democrats say Republicans' real motivation is to block any accomplishments Democrats might take credit for in upcoming campaigns. The filibuster could last into next week, and Democratic leaders are threatening to keep the Senate in session round the clock. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
North Korea and the U.S. have resumed talks on Pyongyang's nuclear program. The two sides met for about 4 hours today and have agreed to continue discussions tomorrow. On Wall Street, stocks closed lower today. The Dow Industrials losing 5.38 points to close at 38.31.75. Trading was heavy, 298 million shares. This is NPR News in Washington. President Clinton signed a bill this morning designed to encourage lending in inner cities. He said the $382 million measure is an example of what he believes should be the goal of government in the future. Most of the money will go to grants to existing lending organizations, many of which are nonprofit. Sinn Féin President Gerry Adams has been granted a visa to enter the United States. He begins a two-week trip tomorrow. NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports from London.
This is the second time Adams has been granted a visa to visit the U.S. He received a 48-hour entry permit in February, which limited him to staying in New York. This visa is less restrictive on travel, although he's not allowed to engage in fundraising. Sinn Féin officials said the purpose of the trip was to capitalize on the IRA's 23-day-old ceasefire. The Sinn Féin leader will fly to Boston tomorrow, then go on an 8-city coast-to-coast tour. In Washington, he's expected to meet with members of Congress, but it's unlikely he will meet with top administration officials. Earlier this week, Vice President Al Gore met with John Hume, leader of Northern Ireland's largest Catholic nationalist party, the SDLP, and with members of the largest Protestant party, the Ulster Unionists. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
Officials are blaming improper food handling for an outbreak of E. coli poisoning at a New York festival 2 weeks ago. 9 people who attended Oktoberfest in Rochester became ill, and another 20 cases are suspected. All of the victims ate meat at the fair. Officials inspected all of the meat processing plants which supplied the event and found no trace of contamination. They now say a worker with dirty hands may have been the cause. The Coast Guard says it has ended its stepped-up patrols to intercept Cuban boat people. Since early August, the Coast Guard picked up more than 30,000 refugees in the Florida Straits, but a spokesman says the number has dwindled to a trickle since the U.S. and Cuba reached agreement 2 weeks ago. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Leonard Feather, one of the world's most prominent jazz critics, died of pneumonia yesterday at the age of 80. Jazz critic Francis Davis once wrote of him, "No other critic has fought the good fight longer on as many fronts or communicated the joys of jazz to as many generations of readers." Leonard Feather grew up in England and moved to America in 1940. Feather became the syndicated jazz columnist for the L.A. Times. His most important writing was his Encyclopedia of Jazz, an essential reference work of musician bios. He'd spent his final months editing a new edition, which is scheduled for publication next year. Feather also produced about 200 recording sessions, composed for many of the musicians he worked with, and even played piano for some of their dates. Throughout his career, he campaigned on behalf of women in jazz and worked for racial equality in the field. I spoke with him in 1987 and asked him if he heard much jazz in England before he moved here.
There wasn't too much in person, but there was a certain amount on records. Actually, the reason I got into the music world in the first place was listening to a record of Louis Armstrong, West End Blues, which was released in England, which made a tremendous impression on me. And it was fairly easy to buy a substantial number of American recordings, but there were not very many British jazz musicians of any consequence. That's why I started coming to New York.
How did you start writing about jazz? There really weren't many people writing seriously about that music.
No, it was really almost by accident. I wrote a letter to the editor of The Melody Maker, a London publication, which turned out to be kind of provocative. I asked why there wasn't any jazz in 3/4 time, which apparently at that time seemed very revolutionary. And there were a lot of letters attacking me and defending me and so forth. And as a result of that, and another controversial letter that I sent in, I got to meet the editor of the Melody Maker, and he asked me if I'd like to write an article for them. So I just started writing regularly for that publication and eventually for a number of others, including American publications.
And you knew that that's what you wanted to do?
Well, yeah, within a couple of years, I decided that in fact, I was working at a film studio outside London for very little money and absolutely no satisfaction. So finally, I was making more money on the outside and enjoying myself more, writing about music and also writing music, which I'd begun to do around the same time. And I decided that was where my future lay, so I gave up the job with the movie company and went on my first visit to New York.
How did this go over in your family? In your autobiography, you describe your family as a Jewish middle-class family that expected conformity.
Yes, they really couldn't quite figure me out for a while. I suppose I seemed to be some kind of a strange rebel to them, and they really didn't quite understand the music or why I was involved in it. But then when they began to see my name in the papers a lot and began to see that I was making a very good living for myself and I was writing music and producing records and doing all these things, they accepted it.
You went to America in 1935. Did you have plans? Mm-hmm. Did you know what you'd be doing once you got there?
Well, yes, I was very fortunate in having met John Hammond, whom you presumably know about, who was the great talent scout of jazz history. He had discovered Count Basie and Billie Holiday and so many other people. And John met me at the dock when I got off the Normandy and took me around. I think within the first 24 hours, I'd been to the Apollo Theater in Harlem and the Savoy Ballroom and went to a number of other places with John and with other friends that I made on that visit. And it was just sort of getting to know what was then my spiritual home, in effect. And I came back on several other visits and eventually settled in New York and lived there for 20 years before moving out to California.
Jazz was very segregated in the 1930s when you came to America, even in the North. What were some of the manifestations of that kind of segregation up north in New York where you were?
I had some very shocking experiences. I had read about racism, and I had read some of the black newspapers, and I had made a couple of black friends in England, principally Louis Armstrong, who came to visit there, and a bit later, Benny Carter, who's a close friend of mine to this day. But I really wasn't quite prepared for what I encountered when I came to New York. One time I was soliciting ads for the Melody Maker. That was the only way I could get them to subsidize my trip to New York. And I went to see the manager of a band leader named Freddie Martin, who's dead now. And the manager looked at a dummy page that I'd set up, which had a picture of Duke Ellington, whose manager had taken an ad. And he looked at me with a blank expression and said, "What? You want to put Freddie on the same page with a nigger?" And that was quite a shock to me, to say the least. And there were things like that happening all the time. I invited Andy Kirk, a great black band leader, to my hotel for a drink, and we were forced to use the freight elevator in my hotel. I ran across situations like that that I really had not been prepared for, but of course black Americans were prepared for it, and they lived their lives that way. And this is, I'm talking about 50 years ago, but it didn't get much better for a long, long time.
This is something I guess you couldn't have been really aware of in England, where there wasn't a very large black population.
Exactly. It was a very small black population in those days, and but there was discrimination, but it was not as overt as it was in the United States. And, of course, there were no lynchings in England, thank God.
Some of the clubs in New York were segregated. The performers were frequently black, but the audiences were white. I'm thinking especially of the Cotton Club. What was the attitude that you and John Hammond, who was your guide at the beginning, toward going to clubs like that? Would you go to hear a big band?
I never went to the Cotton Club, and in a way I kind of regret it in retrospect, because I would have been curious to see what it was really like. But I had heard that black people were prevented from going to the club as patrons. They were only used as employees, as performers. And since I objected to that in principle, I didn't want to be a part of that kind of an attitude, and I never went there. I went to a lot of other clubs in Harlem that did not discriminate, like Small's Paradise and so forth. But the Cotton Club is one place I never did see, except in that terrible movie they made a couple of years ago.
You didn't like it?
Oh, it was awful. They hardly had Duke Ellington in it at all, and it was just a gangster movie. It could have been a very interesting movie about the great stars of black show business, but it wasn't.
Both you and John Hammond became very active in trying to desegregate jazz. What were some of the things that you did in that direction?
I think one of the most important things I did was organize a panel of experts for Esquire magazine, along with the late Robert Goffin, who was a Belgian jazz expert, and we put this panel of experts together. And when the winners were announced, it was decided by Esquire magazine to place them all in a concert together and have the concert very widely publicized. It was the first concert ever given at the Metropolitan Opera House. And what was interesting about it was that up until that time, most of the jazz polls had been in Downbeat and Metronome magazines, and the winners were for the most part white. Most white musicians had a great advantage, regardless of their talent or lack of it, over blacks. Whereas in our poll, with the experts voting, not the public, the majority of the winners were black. People like Louis Armstrong and Roy Eldridge and Art Tatum and so forth, who had not, for the most part, won awards before. And they all took part together in this fantastic concert at the Metropolitan Opera House. And there was another concert the following year out here at the Philharmonic in Los Angeles. And I think that drew attention to a lot of great black musicians on the broadcast that we had of those events, and in the magazine, which ran regular features on jazz, which I wrote along with other writers for several years.
You also worked for a time at Cafe Society, which was the first mixed club in New York. What was different about Cafe Society than the other clubs of the period?
Well, the main difference was that the manager was a owner, a man named Barney Josephson, and the talent consultant unofficially was John Hammond. And between them, they managed to get some of the great talents of the day, like Billie Holiday, Teddy Wilson and his orchestra, the famous Boogie Woogie pianist, many, many others. Hazel Scott was a big hit there, too. And in addition to having a lot of great black talent and some fine white talent also, they did not discriminate at all in their treatment of customers. And unfortunately, in those days, there was still a certain amount of residual discrimination at the clubs on 52nd Street and elsewhere in town. So Cafe Society was sort of a haven of freedom from prejudice at a time when it was very difficult to find a club like that in New York. And I was the assistant to the press agent for that room, so I had access to it at all times. I could go and see Lena Horne working there and all these other great artists, and it was truly a thrill.
We're listening to a 1987 interview with jazz critic Leonard Feather. He died yesterday at the age of 80. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with our 1987 interview with Leonard Feather. You've produced a lot of sessions over the years, and some of the people who you produced would record songs that you've written. Did that ever seem like a possible conflict of interest to you? Would you just see if the musicians wanted to record one of your songs?
Well, I suppose it could be looked as a conflict of interest, except for the fact that more often than not, I went over the material with the artists, and they selected what they did like and didn't like. Like with Dinah Washington, as it turned out, I gave her four blues, two of which turned out to be very, very big hits for her. And so it was doing more good than harm to give them material like that. And when George Shearing made the first session, he wanted to save his compositions for a subsequent date he was going to make for MGM. So I said, well, why don't you just give us some music for this date? So it was his suggestion, not mine. And so forth. It didn't really happen too much that I got involved in composing unless it was a mutual agreement with the artists.
In the 1940s, when Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie came onto the scene and were playing a very new, radical kind of jazz, you were one of their supporters, and a lot of jazz fans thought that all jazz should be traditional New Orleans-based music. And you describe the moldy fig wars of the 1940s,
yeah.
Which you were right in the middle of.
Yes, I really was, because I stuck my neck out. I felt that people like Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker and Bud Powell and Sarah Vaughan and various others were sort of the wave of the future in jazz. And there were a large number of critics at that time, and even some musicians who objected very violently to my views. And as a matter of fact, I incurred so much hostility on the part of other critics that I started putting pseudonyms on my compositions, because I knew if I didn't, I would get a bad review. And I went on doing that for quite a number of years. But eventually it all died down, and most of the people who had been opposing bebop, which was the new music of the 40s, wound up accepting it and in many cases producing records of it themselves. That's even true of my very good friend, the late John Hammond, who first was really strongly opposed to bebop and eventually became a good friend of Dizzy Gillespie, and he recorded one or two bebop artists.
You know how in a lot of ways the war in Vietnam has never been resolved? The people who took sides back when the war was on are still taking sides now. Is it still that way in the Moldy Fig Wars? The people who were against Parker, aside from John Hammond, do you still not...
There's hardly anybody left now except for very, very few diehard reactionary holdouts that really feel as strongly against what was then called the new music, because by now it's more or less traditional. You know, what we thought of as very avant-garde in the 1940s is part of the jazz mainstream today. It's the way most people grow up playing. So it's pretty much impossible to take a position against it.
Jazz critic, composer, and producer Leonard Feather is my guest. Another contribution that you've made to jazz is the production of many sessions by women, musicians as well as vocalists, and you put together several groups of women musicians, women playing by themselves without men. Was that considered strange by male musicians? Words like sexism didn't even exist at the time you were producing these groups.
No, that's right. And we call women girls, too.
That's right. And chicks.
And chicks, yeah. I made an album called Cats versus Chicks, but that was the only way to get the album made. It was to put it on the basis of a contest between an all-male group playing certain tunes, and an all-female group playing the same tunes back-to-back. And the main thing was that it enabled me to record, say, a very fine trumpeter named Norma Carson, who had never made any records before or since, and a wonderful pianist named Beryl Booker, who died some years ago, whose career I had a large hand in because I produced most of her records. And I recorded an all-female session once with Mary Lou Williams, the only time she ever did that. And I was recorded as far back as my London days. I recorded a wonderful pianist and singer named Una Mae Carlisle. And then I got to convince the people at RCA, one producer there who was very friendly, that I wanted to produce an all-female album called Girls in Jazz. And I got the International Sweethearts of Rhythm, which was a famous big band of that day. And I got another couple of all-star groups, one with Mary Lou Williams, one with Beryl Booker, and one with a bass player named Vivian Gary out here in Los Angeles, and we made a very good album. In those days, the album consisted of 4 78 records, the kind of heavy albums. But that's what it was, an all-female album, the first thing of that kind that was ever done. And I've been recording great female musicians ever since. For example, there's a wonderful young trumpeter out here in Los Angeles named Stacey Rolls. She's the daughter of the pianist Jimmy Rolls. And I produced an album with her a couple of years ago, and I think she is just a remarkable musician, and she still hasn't had the acknowledgement, the reception that she deserves, mainly because there really is still a great deal of sexism in the music industry.
Is there anything that especially surprises you about recent developments in jazz, things that you would have never expected back in the mid-30s when you first came to America?
Well, yes, it's expanded a great deal in terms of the variety of meters involved. You have jazz in 5/4 time and 11/4 time and various other times. And originally, my whole career was based on the fact that I wrote this provocative letter saying there should be jazz in 3/4 time. Well, now you get that everywhere. And there are much longer, extended compositions, and the whole form of jazz has expanded so much. We used to be confined to mostly 3-minute performances on the 78 RPM records. Now you may have a suite that lasts 20 or 25 minutes. You may have solos that last for many, many choruses. Everything has gotten sort of bigger and in some respects better, although not necessarily just because it's bigger. But it has really improved. And also the musicians nowadays tend to be a great deal better equipped in terms of education. Because when I came up, jazz education was almost a contradiction in terms. Now we have places like the Berklee College of Music in Boston and many, many other colleges around the country where jazz is an official subject for credit courses, not only the history of jazz, but the technique and the instruments and so forth. And we got a lot of wonderful young players coming up out of these schools.
Jazz critic Leonard Feather, recorded in 1987. Feather died of pneumonia yesterday at the age of 80. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing from reporter David Wellner about what's happened in Port-au-Prince, Haiti today. Also, Anne Garrels gives us a little outlook on the visit of Boris Yeltsin to the U.S. next week and what's happened in Russia in the year since Yeltsin retained his hold on the presidency by attacking the Soviet parliament. Also on today's program, we'll be hearing about the week in Washington, which has included some legislative developments, and also a bit of a reorganization of the White House staff. And in New York, we'll hear from reporter Melissa Block about Michael Bergen. He's a fellow you've seen a lot of recently. He is the model in the Calvin Klein underwear ads, the brief ads.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Michael Tolkien made his name by writing the Hollywood novel The Player and then by turning out the screenplay for the Robert Altman film of the same name. Tolkien also wrote and directed The Rapture, a film about a woman who becomes a born-again Christian just in time for the apocalypse. Now he's written and directed something slightly more down-to-earth. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The New Age.
Michael Tolkien's new movie takes place in a Los Angeles that can only be described as very L.A., a world where people own chic Ed Ruscha paintings and sit in chic Frank Gehry chairs and moan about their chic empty jobs. Judy Davis plays Catherine, a graphic designer, and Peter Weller plays her husband Peter, who's either an agent or an advertising executive, it's hard to tell which, and it doesn't matter, because right at the beginning of the film, he decides to quit his job, just to see what, as he puts it, the next step in my journey is going to be. Searching for himself, the first thing he finds is that he and Catherine are living very expensively, and they're about to run out of money. What to do? Throw a big party, of course, for all their chic friends, many of whom they seem to have slept with, or intend to soon. The next morning, out by the pool, Peter and Catherine's mutual exasperation boils over.
I mean, what is money, huh? Money isn't money. You think it's money? Money's not money. Money's just an expression of something else. Money will express itself. If we need money, money will express itself. It's like love. If there's love here, love will express itself. I mean, these are my feelings, like support. I just need support, Catherine. You know, I need a push.
You'd fall over. You'd break.
Yeah, you'd like to think so, wouldn't you? I mean, I'm trying to get to something here, the bottom of something here, and the least you can do is be nice. I mean, it's your big weapon, isn't it? It's what everybody adores about you, how nice you are.
I wasn't nice last night.
No. You were bad.
Don't be cute. You quit your job with no place else to go. You can't afford to be cute.
It's just my inner child showing through.
Your inner child is running us into bankruptcy. Why don't you get in touch with your inner adult?
Now what? They try opening a clothing store called Hypocrisy, shorthand for Hip Aristocracy. It's a place where they sell what Catherine calls wonderful sarcastic resort dresses. They try living separate lives under the same roof, even taking lovers under each other's noses. They try going to various New Age groups. They party with what the movie calls the usual art and spirituality and S&M crowd. They try telephone sales. They even try a suicide pact. In the end, though, all they find is emptiness and more emptiness. The worst of it is they themselves are pretty empty to begin with. And though Tolkien's screenplay is frequently very clever in its bitter way, cleverness alone isn't enough to sustain a sour ball of a movie like this one. A comic approach might have worked wonders, but instead, Tolkien goes for something tony and bleak. Cinematographer John Campbell has contributed perfect ice-white lighting, and Mark Mothersbaugh has provided equally appropriate spooky, tinkly music. Peter Weller and Judy Davis are both terrific actors, and they invest their characters with as much life and passion and anger as they can. But it all seems oddly out of place. Try as they may, Weller and Davis can't make these two hollow, trivial characters seem anything but hollow and trivial. And though Tolkien seems to be exploring big issues, he's doing it on such a dinky scale that the movie can only be described as cosmically shallow. The New Age is a film that asks the question, what happens when nothingness befalls two nobodies? The unsurprising answer, not much.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Sue Spolin and Barbara Bogave, research assistance from Becky Cohn. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the autobiography of a face. As a child, Lucy Greeley had a form of cancer that destroyed her face. After dozens of reconstructive operations, she's written a memoir about beauty and self-image turned upside down. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.